This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Wednesday thanked European Union's lawmakers for declaring Russia a, quote, state sponsor of terrorism, and said authorities are doing everything possible to restore energy to the country plunged into darkness because of Russian airstrikes. A punishing new barrage of Russian strikes on Ukrainian infrastructure on Wednesday caused power outages across large parts of the country as well as neighboring Moldova, piling more damage onto Ukraine's already battered power network and adding to the misery for civilians as winter begins. Mourners gathered at a cemetery in Jerusalem on Wednesday for the funeral of a 15-year-old killed in an explosion in Jerusalem. Two explosions near bus stops in Jerusalem at the height of the rush hour killed the teenager and injured at least 18 in what Israeli police said were attacks by Palestinians. The violence came as Israeli-Palestinian tensions are high amid Israeli raids in the occupied West Bank. A 6-year-old boy has been pulled from the rubble of a deadly Indonesia earthquake after spending 2 days trapped under debris without food or water in a miracle rescue. The dramatic rescue captured on camera Wednesday evening revived hopes that survivors could still be pulled alive from the wreckage days after the strong tremor hit West Java on Monday, killing at least 271 people. Video showed rescue workers pulling the boy free from a destroyed home, wearing the blue shirt and trousers he had on when he became trapped. Find more on our website, voanews.com, or follow us on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. African leaders have declared a ceasefire in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo starting Friday, which is aimed at stopping attacks by the M23 rebel group, they said in a statement. The declaration was issued by the leaders of Congo, Rwanda, Burundi, and Angola, and former Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta after a summit on Wednesday aimed at finding solutions to the East Congo crisis. Eastern Congo is facing an insurgency by the M23, a Tutsi-led rebel group which the Congolese government claims is supporting neighboring Rwanda. Rwanda denies this, but M23's resurgence this year has caused a major diplomatic crisis. Nigeria launched oil and gas drilling for the first time in the country's north on Tuesday as it seeks to diversify away from the oil-rich Niger Delta. Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston has more.
President Muhammadu Buhari said the field has reserves of 1 billion barrels and 500 billion cubic feet of gas.
We are able to attract investment of over $3 billion United States dollars to this project.
The Kolmani facility, which will include an oil refinery, gas processing unit, 300-megawatt power plant, and a fertilizer plant, is a departure from Nigeria's traditional oil heartlands in the Niger Delta. That region has been blighted for decades by oil spills into farmland, creeks, and lagoons.
A Walmart employee killed 6 people and wounded several others before fatally shooting himself at a store in the eastern U.S. state of Virginia, authorities said on Wednesday. In the latest episode of gun violence in the United States, Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman reports.
The Tuesday attack came during a busy holiday week and is the latest episode of mass gun violence in America. Chesapeake Police Chief Mark Selesky said the shooter was found dead at the scene. Tuesday's bloodshed comes just days after a gunman killed 5 and injured 17 at a Colorado LGBTQ nightclub, and also follows an attack in Charlottesville, Virginia, when 3 members of the University of Virginia football team were shot and killed after a suspect opened fire on a bus full of students. Walmart employee Brianna Tyler told ABC News that the shooter was a manager at the store, saying, quote, "I looked up and my manager just opened the door and he just opened fire."
UNICEF officials say a cholera outbreak sweeping through Haiti is growing a number in children amid surge in malnutrition. The UN agency said Wednesday the deadly combination means about 40% of cholera cases in the impoverished country of more than 11 million now involve children, with 9 out of 10 cases reported in areas where people are starving. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Thank you. Today's Thursday, November 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. sends more military aid as Russia continues a punishing barrage of strikes on Ukraine's energy infrastructure.
The latest package is $400 million in weapons, ammunition, and generators. It'll come from the Pentagon's own stockpiles in a bid to get the aid out as fast as possible.
Changes to common perceptions of those who suffer from HIV/AIDS highlighted as the world marks AIDS Day.
When I was first diagnosed, there was only a couple medications, and it was purely a matter of maintain until the inevitable happens. I was one of the lucky ones.
And another day, another shocker at the Qatar World Cup. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned.
The latest package is $400 million in weapons, ammunition.
A punishing new barrage of Russian strikes on Ukrainian infrastructure has caused power outages across large parts of the country, as well as neighboring Moldova, piling more damage onto already battered power network and adding to the misery for civilians as winter begins. This as the U.S. is sending more military aid to Kyiv. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The latest package is $400 million in weapons, ammunition, and generators. It'll come from the Pentagon's own stockpiles in a bid to get the aid out as fast as possible. But the continued push raises questions about just how long the U.S. and its partners can keep sustaining the fight without impacting their own military readiness. Many European nations say they've already pushed out all the excess equipment they can afford to send. The Pentagon's top weapons buyer met with partners in Brussels last week to discuss how to keep the weapons flowing. Sagar Magani, Washington.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris visited Palawan Island in the Philippines and reaffirmed U.S. support for UN ruling that rejected China's maritime claims in the South China Sea. Harris is in the country as a show of U.S. support for its ally amid Beijing's increasingly assertive stance in the region. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widaskuwara has this report.
Meeting local communities in the Philippines island of Palawan, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris underscored the consequences of illegal fishing, a regional problem with China as its biggest offender.
The Vice President is the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit the South China Sea island, just 330 kilometers east of the disputed Spratly Islands, claimed entirely by China and partly by the Philippines, Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, and Vietnam.
As the United States has long made clear, we support the 2016 ruling of the UN Arbitral Tribunal, which delivered a unanimous and final decision firmly rejecting China's expansive South China Sea maritime claims.
China, the Philippines, Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, and Vietnam have competing territorial claims in various parts of the sea, with Beijing claiming most of it. Skirmishes have occurred, current Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr.
The upheavals that we are seeing, especially in the, not only in the region, but especially in the region, this partnership become even more important.
Harris' visit was designed to show support for one of Washington's oldest allies in Asia. During her Monday meeting with Marcos, she said an attack on the Philippines would invoke U.S. mutual defense. China shot back. As China increases military activity in the region, Washington is seeking to repair ties with Manila after fraught relations under previous President Rodrigo Duterte. Like many in the region, the current Marcos government seeks to navigate the U.S.-China rivalry by adopting the friend-to-all and enemy-to-none policy. Of Washington's five treaty allies in the Indo-Pacific, the Philippines is closest to Taiwan and therefore central to U.S. plans to deter and respond to a potential Chinese threat on the self-administered island that Beijing views as a wayward province. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Jakarta, Indonesia.
Thank you, Patsy. Britain's economy will shrink by 0.4% in 2023, more than any other in the G7 group of world's richest nations, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, analysts say global economic pressures have been compounded by recent political chaos.
The Gray family is getting ready for Christmas. The children are growing more excited by the day, but mother Haley is struggling.
So I'm having to make sure I've got money for gas and electric. I ain't going to be able to do it. They're going to have hardly anything come Christmas.
Worries that are being felt across Britain. Living standards over the next 2 years are forecast to fall by the biggest amount since records began in 1956. Charity food banks are seeing unprecedented demand. Charlotte Hill is head of the Felix Project Food Bank in London.
It used to be that those were people on the margins of society who couldn't access a kitchen, you know, homeless people who needed that support. Now it's people in work. It's people who can't afford to turn on their cookers who are needing support.
The pain is likely to get worse with new tax hikes and spending cuts on the way. The government blames the coronavirus and Russia. British Chancellor Jeremy Hunt announced the new measures to Parliament November 17th.
The lasting impact on supply chains has made goods more expensive and fueled inflation, and this has been worsened by a made-in-Russia energy crisis.
Those crises are global, but Britain has unique problems, says analyst John Kampfner of the London-based policy institute Chatham House.
They are compounded in Britain by a series of ideologically driven governments whose competence was very much open to question, culminating in the disastrous 45 days of Liz Truss.
Prime Minister Liz Truss's plans to slash taxes and raise spending sent borrowing costs soaring and the pound plummeting, ultimately forcing her to resign last month. The effects are still being felt. For the first time since records began, Paris last week overtook London as Europe's biggest stock market. Analysts say Britain has other homemade problems. Britain's vote to leave the European Union brought new trade barriers. Overnight, cheesemaker Simon Spurrell lost $285,000 worth of European business. This year, he decided to sell his company to a bigger rival with access to the European market.
We no longer have access to the EU. It meant that we needed to actually try and find a solution.
It's clear that Brexit is holding back growth, says Kampfner.
It was camouflaged by the pandemic in 2020 and 2021. So the direct consequences of many of the Brexit decisions couldn't be discerned. They are now. Eventually, belatedly, being seen.
Prime Minister Sunak this week insisted Brexit can be a success.
I voted for Brexit, I believe in Brexit, and I know that Brexit can deliver, and is already delivering, enormous benefits and opportunities for the country.
The government says economic belt tightening now will mean a shorter recession, but for millions of Britons, Christmas cheer will be muted and the coming years will be tough. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Many things have changed since AIDS was first identified as a disease in 1981, from advances in medical treatment to common perceptions of those who suffer from the disease. On World AIDS Day, which was founded in 1988, VOA's Carol Van Dam talks to one man from Midwestern city of Madison, Wisconsin, who has lived with the disease for 30 years. Tim, who prefers to be identified by his first name only, says back when he was diagnosed in the early 1990s, AIDS was considered a death sentence.
When I was first diagnosed, there was only a couple medications, and it was purely a matter of maintain, you know, until the inevitable happens. I was one of the lucky ones, shall we say, that the protease inhibitors came out at a time where I was still healthy enough to take them.
When you talk about those pro inhibitors, can you describe that a little bit, what that means?
There are a number of different classes of drugs. I am a bit rusty on the most recent developments, but at the time there were four. Protease inhibitors were the third drug category. And what that means is that they develop different drugs to attack the virus at different stages of its development. And much as they do with cancer now, that hit it at different spots in the replication. And protease inhibitors were a drug that actually attacked a specific enzyme in the duplication. Previous to that point, They were, AZT was one of the first bigger ones, and its side effects were horrible. And it was a 24-hour-a-day drug, meaning you had to wake up in the middle of the night to take it.
Did you have to do that for a while, AZT?
No, thank goodness I didn't.
What were the reactions of the people around you, including your own family, when you told them?
The whole gamut. At that time, I was quite active in the local AIDS support organization. So I was giving care to people with HIV. So people that were knowledgeable about the disease were supportive, tremendously supportive. And then it ran to questions like, why did you tell me? That's too stressful for me. I don't want to know that type of thing.
And you ran into that even with loved ones?
Yes, very close.
That must have been difficult.
It was at the time, definitely. In retrospect, you have to realize, I learned to realize that people have emotional responses based on their own life experience. And if they had never been through a life-challenging illness, or certainly one of this type that was from a minority, a discriminated minority, they have nothing to base that on, the care and compassion and empathy, because they're not a gay person, they're not a Black person, they're not an IV drug user, they're not a sex worker. And those categories didn't tend to promote a lot of sympathy or empathy at the time.
Right. I remember living through the early 1990s, and I remember, too, that attitudes changed slowly, but they did change. And by the time between the mid-1980s to the early 1990s. So did you feel that over that time and from the years after that in the 90s, that slowly people started to change their attitudes and they weren't afraid, oh, my gosh, if I interact with him, I'm going to get it or I might be exposed?
Yes, primarily due to the prevention efforts and the education efforts of the AIDS support organizations, yes. But this might sound harsh, but hope came, in my mind, from the new generation getting older. So many things, unfortunately, it takes the older generation not making the decisions anymore and younger people coming onto the table to start that discussion. And the world is totally different than when I came out as being gay and having HIV.
That's Tim, a healthcare practitioner from Madison, Wisconsin, who has traveled twice to Africa to create awareness about AIDS, speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. In other news, another World Cup day, another shocker. Substitutes Ritsu Doan and Takuma Asano scored late goals on Wednesday as Japan came from behind to upset Germany 2-1. On Tuesday, Argentina lost 2-1 to Saudi Arabia. Spain's young squad got off to a high-scoring start by routing Costa Rica 7-0. Dani Olmo, Marco Asensio and Ferran Torres scored a goal each in the first 34 minutes. Torres, Gavi, Carlos Soler and Alvaro Morata added to the lead in the second half. Two of the world's best players start world competition Thursday as Cristiano Ronaldo and Neymar both seek history in Qatar. Ronaldo is attempting to become the first male soccer player to score in five different World Cups when he leads Portugal against Ghana. Neymar is the leader of a Brazilian team seeking a record-extending sixth World Cup title. South Korea plays Uruguay and Switzerland faces Cameroon in other games. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Australia's latest official climate survey says days of extreme heat are becoming more frequent and sea levels continue to rise. The State of the Climate report is released jointly by the Bureau of Meteorological and the SCRO, the National Science Agency. It blames rising greenhouse gas emissions for warmer temperatures. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
The State of the Climate report is published every 2 years. Released Wednesday, the 2022 study states that Australia's climate has warmed by about 1.5 degrees Celsius since national records began in 1910. The report anticipates more frequent heat waves and more intense heavy rainfall. It asserts that bushfire seasons will be longer and increasingly dangerous. The study said the severity of warmer temperatures would depend on the speed at which global greenhouse gas emissions can be reduced. Even a downturn in industry and transport during the COVID-19 pandemic, the research found, hasn't been enough to slow global warming. Jackie Brown is a senior research scientist and the director of the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, or CSIRO's Climate Science Centre. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation Wednesday that climatic conditions in Australia would become more intense.
Australia, as you know, we're droughts, we're floods, and we just alternate between those two. And it's the fact that we're going to see more of those and that happening in more extreme ways.
Parts of eastern Australia remain on flood alert after record-breaking rainfall. Associate Professor Ailey Gallant from Monash University told local media that the report highlighted clear evidence that Australia's climate is changing and said deep and aggressive cuts to carbon emissions were needed. Australia's Minister for Industry and Science, Ed Husic, told reporters Wednesday that the research reinforced the urgent need for action on climate change. For the first time, Australia has a legislated target to cut greenhouse gas outputs. In August, new laws were passed by the Federal Parliament in Canberra that would cut carbon emissions by 43% by 2030. Australia has been one of the world's worst per capita emitters of greenhouse pollution. Coal and gas still generate most of its electricity. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
With cars becoming smarter, some researchers say it's time for road infrastructure, traffic lights, highway signs and roads themselves to communicate with drivers. Jinia Dulu has this story from Irvine, California.
One of two major intersections in the Californian city of Irvine, equipped with a new kind of traffic sensor. If it detects an uptick in the number of cars, it might automatically change the traffic signal timing, extending green lights. Its smarts can identify pedestrians and bicyclists and will one day tell approaching drivers through their mapping apps about upcoming hazards. The core of the new tech is LiDAR, a sensor very much like a radar that uses light rather than sound to map the intersection and its surroundings. Video cameras have long been used at intersections, but don't provide real-time information to drivers. LiDAR's spinning sensors, which see 80 meters away and a 360-degree view, provide data that can be processed on the spot and turned into information a driver might need to change behavior. For Irvine's mayor, the technology brings the promise of reducing pedestrian, bicycle, and car accidents. The project supporters point out that the technology doesn't reveal personal information, like a license plate number or a person's identity. The city is planning to outfit 25 more intersections with LiDARs, employing artificial intelligence not only to improve traffic flows in the city, but also to increase energy efficiency. Jenya Dulu for VOA News, Irvine, California.
This is Science in a Minute.
Several studies and findings made by spacecraft, rovers, and landers from NASA and other space agencies suggest that some 4.5 billion years ago, Mars had a thick, rich atmosphere and oceans of flowing water on its surface, which could have possibly supported life. A new study published in the journal Science Advances proposes that early in its evolution, the red planet was covered with water with an average depth of 300 meters. The study led by researchers at the University of Copenhagen suggests all of that water came from ice-filled asteroids, which showered the planet for its first 100 million years. Study authors also found that the asteroids brought important biological molecules like amino acids to Mars. Amino acids are one of the important building blocks that make life possible. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
We're bringing women's voices to the conversation on things that matter to hearts and minds of women.
Here in Kinshasa, campaigns to raise awareness against the spread of coronavirus are common, but getting that information to people who have no access to water, electricity, or money can be a challenge.
With strong opinions and expertise on things that impact and change their lives.
I think a big thing for me is just being able to say that when these protests are happening, does it turn around into policy?
From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent.
It really was powerful because it showed what is possible when men and women band together and say enough is enough.
We hear your voices, women's voices, our voices, and add your voice to the conversation. Each week, right here on The Voice of America, on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris is visiting a western Philippines island province at the edge of the South China Sea to amplify America's support and underline U.S. interest in freedom of navigation in the disputed waters. We'll discuss this and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Encounter. Next, a Mideast update. From shaky U.S.-Saudi relations, the politics of the World Cup in Qatar, Iran's crackdown on anti-regime protesters, and its growing military ties with Russia, to the return of Bibi Netanyahu in Israel, we revisit some top stories in the region with experts Ellen Lapson and Hussein Ibish. A Mideast update, next on Encounter, on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Junior Ruffo in Washington. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In early November, North Korea, formerly known as the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or DPRK, launched another barrage of missiles, including a surface-to-air missile that landed a mere 57 kilometers from South Korea, formerly known as the Republic of Korea, or ROK. Another of the missiles launched in early November was an intercontinental ballistic missile the DPRK claims is capable of carrying a nuclear warhead. Pyongyang announced that the launches were practiced for a quote-unquote merciless attack on ROK and U.S. targets. Speaking at a United Nations Security Council briefing on the DPRK's missile firings, U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, condemned in the strongest possible terms all recent DPRK missile launches since October 27. She noted that the latest test of an intercontinental ballistic missile is particularly concerning. Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield declared that the DPRK's aggressive behavior is more than just advancing the DPRK's unlawful military capabilities and undermining the global nonproliferation regime. This is also about the DPRK trying to purposely raise tensions and stoke fear in its neighbors. In response to the DPRK's aggressive behavior over the past several months, the United States and the ROK have further deepened their cooperation to bolster their shared security. In July, the United States deployed fifth-generation fighter aircraft to the ROK, and in October, the USS Ronald Reagan Carrier Strike Group redeployed to the Sea of Japan after Pyongyang launched a long-range ballistic missile over Japan. The day after the DPRK's early November missile barrage, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin and ROK Defense Minister Lee Jong-sup met at the Pentagon for the previously scheduled 54th U.S. Republic of Korea Security Consultative Meeting. The U.S. commitment to defending the ROK is ironclad, said Defense Secretary Austin after the meeting. On the peninsula, he noted, we're returning to large-scale exercises to strengthen our combined readiness and our ability to fight tonight, if necessary. We're committed to building on these efforts to strengthen integrated deterrence and to ensure that this alliance continues to bolster security and stability on the Korean Peninsula and throughout the Indo-Pacific. We will confront the challenges of the future the same way that we have for nearly 70 years, Secretary Austin declared, by standing shoulder to shoulder as proud allies.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.